Truman as a usurper. If not Truman, but he, had been Roosevelt's choice, he would be President of the United States now. Truman knew Burns' attitude, but needed the old pro badly to help him run the country and face the world. Hence the prize of state. The Secretary of State was the highest-ranking member of the cabinet, and under the rules of succession then obtaining, was the officer next in line for the presidency, as well when the vice presidency was vacant. Short of the presidency itself, state was the most powerful office Truman had to give. Vannevar Bush and James Bryant Conant had needed months to convince Henry Stimson to take up consideration of the bomb's challenge in the post-war era. He had not been ready in late October 1944 when Bush pressed him for action, and he had not been ready in early December when Bush pressed him again. By then, Bush knew what he thought the problem needed, however. "We propose that the Secretary of War suggest to the President the establishment of a committee or commission with the duty of preparing plans. These would include the drafting of legislation and the drafting of appropriate releases to be made public at the proper time. We were all in agreement that the State Department should now be brought in." Stimson allowed one of his trusted aides, Harvey H. Bundy, a Boston lawyer, father of William P. and McGeorge, at least to begin formulating a membership roster and list of duties for such a committee. But he did not yet know, even in broad outline, what basic policy to recommend. Bohr's ideas, variously diluted, floated by that time in the Washington air. Bohr had sought to convince the American government that only early discussion with the Soviet Union of the mutual dangers of a nuclear arms race could forestall such an arms race once the bomb became known. He would try again in April to see Roosevelt. Felix Frankfurter and Lord Halifax, the British ambassador, would be strolling in a Washington park discussing Bohr's best avenue of approach when the bells of the city's churches began tolling the news of the president's death. Apparently, no one within the executive branch was sufficiently convinced of the inevitability of Bohr's vision. Stimson was as wise as any man in government, but late in December he cautioned Roosevelt that the Russians should earn the right to hear the baleful news. "I told him of my views as to the future of S-1, Stimson's code for the bomb, in connection with Russia, that I knew they were spying on our work, but had not yet gotten any real knowledge of it, and that, while I was troubled about the possible effect of keeping from them even now that work, I believed that it was essential not to take them into our confidence until we were sure to get a real quid pro quo from our frankness. I said I had no illusions as to the possibility of keeping permanently such a secret, but that I did not think it was yet time to share it with Russia. He said he thought he agreed with me." In mid-February, after talking again to Bush, Stimson confided to his diary what he wanted in exchange for news of the bomb. Bohr's conviction that only an open world modeled in some sense on the Republic of Science could answer the challenge of the bomb had drifted, in Bush's mind, to a proposal for an international pool of scientific research. Of such an arrangement, Stimson wrote that it would be inadvisable to put it into full force yet until we had gotten all we could in Russia in the way of liberalization in exchange for S-1. That is, the quid pro quo Stimson thought the United States should demand from the Soviet Union was the democratization of its government. What, for Bohr, was the inevitable outcome of a solution to the problem of the bomb? An open world, where differences in social and political conditions would be visible to everyone, and therefore under pressure to improve, Stimson imagined should be a precondition to any initial exchange. Finally, in mid-March, Stimson talked to Roosevelt, their last meeting. That talk came to no useful end. In April, with a new president in the White House, he prepared to repeat the performance. In the meantime, the men who had advised Franklin Roosevelt were working to convince Harry Truman of the increasing perfidy of the Soviet Union. Avril Harriman, the shrewd multimillionaire ambassador to Moscow, had rushed to Washington to brief the new president. Truman says Harriman told him the visit was based on the fear that you did not understand, as I had seen Roosevelt understand, that Stalin is breaking his agreements. To soften that condescension, Harriman added that he feared Truman could not have had time to catch up with all the recent cables. The self-educated Missourian prided himself on how many pages of documents he could chew through per day. He was a champion reader, and undercut Harriman's condescension breezily by instructing the ambassador to keep on sending me long messages. Harriman told Truman they were faced with a barbarian invasion of Europe. The Soviet Union, he said, meant to take over its neighbors and install the Soviet system of secret police and state control. He added that he was not pessimistic, the president writes, for he felt that it was possible for us to arrive at a workable basis with the Russians. He believed that this would require a reconsideration of our policy, an abandonment of any illusion that the Soviet government was likely soon to act in accordance with the principles to which the rest of the world held in international affairs. Truman was concerned to convince Roosevelt's advisers that he meant to be decisive. I ended the meeting by saying, I intend to be firm in my dealings with the Soviet government. Delegates were arriving in San Francisco that April, for example, to formulate a charter for a new United Nations to replace the old and defunct League. Harriman asked Truman if he would go ahead with the World Organization plans, even if Russia dropped out. Truman remembers responding realistically that, without Russia, there would not be a World Organization. 3 days later, having heard from Stalin in the meantime and met the arriving Soviet Foreign Minister, Vyacheslav Molotov, he retreated from realism to bluster. He felt that our agreements with the Soviet Union had so far been a one-way street, an eyewitness recalls, and that he could not continue. It was now or never. He intended to go on with the plans for San Francisco, and if the Russians did not wish to join us, they could go to hell. Stimson argued for patience. In the big military matters, Truman reports him saying, the Soviet government had kept its word, and the military authorities of the United States had come to count on it. In fact, they had often done better than they had promised. Although George Marshall seconded Stimson's argument, and Truman could not have had two more reliable witnesses, it was not counsel the new and untried president wanted to hear. Marshall added a crucial justification that Truman took to heart. He said, from the military point of view, the situation in Europe was secure, but that we hoped for Soviet participation in the war against Japan at a time when it would be useful to us. The Russians had it within their power to delay their entry into the Far Eastern War until we had done all the dirty work. He was inclined to agree with Mr. Stimson that the possibility of a break with Russia was very serious. Truman could hardly tell the Russians to go to hell if he needed them to finish the Pacific War. Marshall's justification for patience meant Stalin had the president over a barrel. It was not an arrangement Harry Truman intended to perpetuate. He let Molotov know. They had sparred diplomatically at their first meeting. Now, the president attacked. The issue was the composition of the post-war government of Poland. Molotov discussed various formulas, all favoring Soviet dominance. Truman demanded the free elections that he understood had been agreed upon at Yalta. I replied sharply that an agreement had been reached on Poland and that there was only one thing to do, and that was for Marshal Stalin to carry out that agreement in accordance with his word. Molotov tried again. Truman replied sharply again, repeating his previous demand. Molotov hedged once more. Truman proceeded to lay him low. I expressed once more the desire of the United States for friendship with Russia, but I wanted it clearly understood that this could be only on a basis of the mutual observation of agreements and not on the basis of a one-way street. Those are hardly fighting words. Molotov's reaction suggests that the president spoke more pungently at the time. I have never been talked to like that in my life, Molotov said. I told him, carry out your agreements, and you won't get talked to like that. If Truman felt better for the exchange, it disturbed Stimson. The new president had acted without knowledge of the bomb and its potentially fateful consequences. It was time and past time for a full briefing. Truman agreed to meet with Stimson at noon on Wednesday, April 25th. The president was scheduled to address the opening session of the United Nations conference in San Francisco by radio that evening. One more conditioning incident intervened. On Tuesday, he received a communication from Joseph Stalin, one of the most revealing and disquieting messages to reach me during my first days in the White House. Molotov had reported Truman's tough talk to the Soviet premier. Stalin replied in kind. "Poland bordered on the Soviet Union," he wrote, "not on Great Britain or the United States. The question of Poland had the same meaning for the security of the Soviet Union as the question of Belgium and Greece for the security of Great Britain. But the Soviet Union was not consulted when those governments were being established there, following the Allied liberation. The blood of the Soviet people abundantly shed on the fields of Poland in the name of the liberation of Poland demanded a Polish government friendly to Russia. And finally, I am ready to fulfill your request and do everything possible to reach a harmonious solution. But you demand too much of me. In other words, you demand that I renounce the interests of the security of the Soviet Union. But I cannot turn against my country." With this blunt challenge on his mind, Truman received his Secretary of War. Stimson had brought Groves along for technical backup, but left him waiting in an outer office while he discussed issues of general policy. He began dramatically, reading from a memorandum. "Within 4 months, we shall in all probability have completed the most terrible weapon ever known in human history, one bomb of which could destroy a whole city." "We had shared the development with the British," Stimson continued, "but we controlled the factories that made the explosive material, and no other nation could reach this position for some years. It was certain that we would not enjoy a monopoly forever, and probably the only nation which could enter into production within the next few years is Russia. The world in its present state of moral advancement compared with its technical development," the Secretary of War continued quaintly, "would be eventually at the mercy of such a weapon. In other words, modern civilization might be completely destroyed." Stimson emphasized what John Anderson had emphasized to Churchill the year before, that founding a world peace organization while the bomb was still a secret would seem to be unrealistic. "No system of control heretofore considered would be adequate to control this menace, both inside any particular country and between the nations of the world. The control of this weapon will undoubtedly be a matter of the greatest difficulty, and would involve such thoroughgoing rights of inspection and internal controls as we have never heretofore contemplated." That brought Stimson to the crucial point. "Furthermore, in the light of our present position with reference to this weapon, the question of sharing it with other nations, and if so shared, upon what terms, becomes a primary question of our foreign relations." Bohr had proposed to inform other nations of the common dangers of a nuclear arms race. At the hands of Stimson and his advisors, that sensible proposal had drifted to the notion that the issue was sharing the weapon itself. As commander-in-chief, as a veteran of the First World War, as a man of common sense, Truman must have wondered what on earth his Secretary of War was talking about, especially when Stimson added that a certain moral responsibility followed from American leadership in nuclear technology which the nation could not shirk, without very serious responsibility for any disaster to civilization which it would further. Was the United States morally obligated to give away a devastating new weapon of war? Now Stimson called in Groves. The general brought with him a report on the status of the Manhattan Project that he had presented to the Secretary of War 2 days earlier. Both Stimson and Groves insisted Truman read the document while they waited. The president was restive. He had a threatening note from Stalin to deal with. He had to prepare to open the United Nations conference, even though Stimson had just informed him that allowing the conference to proceed in ignorance of the bomb was a sham. A scene of darkening comedy followed as the proud man, who had challenged Averell Harriman to keep sending him long messages, tried to avoid public instruction in the minutiae of a secret project he had fought doggedly as a senator to investigate. Groves misunderstood completely. Mr. Truman did not like to read long reports. This report was not long, considering the size of the project. It was about 24 pages, and he would constantly interrupt his reading to say, "Why, I don't like to read papers." And Mr. Stimson and I would reply, "Well, we can't tell you this in any more concise language. This is a big project." For example, we discussed our relations with the British in about 4 or 5 lines. It was that much condensed. We had to explain all the processes, and we might just say what they were, and that was about all. After the reading of the lesson, Groves notes, a great deal of emphasis was placed on foreign relations, and particularly on the Russian situation. Truman reverting to his immediate problems. He made it very definite, Groves adds, for the record, that he was in entire agreement with the necessity for the project. The final point in Stimson's memorandum was the proposal Bush and Conant had initiated to establish what Stimson called a select committee for recommending action to the executive and legislative branches of our government. Truman approved. In his memoirs, the president describes his meeting with Stimson and Groves with tact and perhaps even a measure of private humor. I listened with absorbed interest, for Stimson was a man of great wisdom and foresight. He went into considerable detail in describing the nature and the power of the projected weapon. Burns had already told me that the weapon might be so powerful as to be capable of wiping out entire cities and killing people on an unprecedented scale. That was when Burns had crowed that the new bombs might allow the United States to dictate its own terms at the end of the war. Stimson, on the other hand, seemed at least as much concerned with the role of the atomic bomb in the shaping of history as in its capacity to shorten this war. I thanked him for his enlightening presentation of this awesome subject, and as I saw him to the door, I felt how fortunate the country was to have so able and so wise a man in its service. High praise. But the president was not sufficiently impressed at the outset with Stimson and Harriman to invite either man to accompany him to the next conference of the Big Three. Both found it necessary, when the time came, to invite themselves. Jimmy Burns went at the president's invitation and sat at the president's right hand. Discussion between Truman and his various advisors was one level of discourse in the spring of 1945 on the uses of the atomic bomb. Another was joined 2 days after Stimson and Groves briefed the president when a target committee under Groves' authority met for the first time in Loris Norstad's conference room at the Pentagon. Brigadier General Thomas F. Farrell, who would represent the Manhattan Project as Groves' deputy to the Pacific Command, chaired the committee. Besides Farrell, it counted 2 other Air Force officers, a colonel and a major, and 5 scientists, including John von Neumann, and British physicist William G. Penny. Groves opened the meeting with a variant of his usual speech to Manhattan Project working groups, how important their duty was, how secret it must be kept. He had already discussed targets with the Military Policy Committee, and now informed his target committee that it should propose no more than 4. Farrell laid down the basics. B-29 range for such important missions no more than 1,500 miles. Visual bombing essential so that these untried and valuable bombs could be aimed with certainty and their effects photographed. Probable targets, urban or industrial Japanese areas, in July, August, or September. Each mission to be given 1 primary and 2 alternate targets, with spotter planes sent ahead to confirm visibility. Most of the first meeting was devoted to worrying about the Japanese weather. After lunch, the committee brought in the 20th Air Force's top meteorologist, who told them that June was the worst weather month in Japan. A little improvement is present in July. A little bit better weather is present in August. September weather is bad. January was the best month, but no one intended to wait that long. The meteorologist said he could forecast a good day for bombing operations only 24 hours ahead, but he could give 2 days' notice of bad weather. He suggested they station submarines near the target areas to radio back weather readings. Later in the afternoon, they began considering targets. Groves had extended Farrell's guidelines. I had set as the governing factor that the targets chosen should be places the bombing of which would most adversely affect the will of the Japanese people to continue the war. Beyond that, they should be military in nature, consisting either of important headquarters or troop concentrations or centers of production of military equipment and supplies. To enable us to assess accurately the effects of the bomb, the targets should not have been previously damaged by air raids. It was also desirable that the first target be of such size that the damage would be confined within it, so that we could more definitely determine the power of the bomb. But such pristine targets had already become scarce in Japan. If the first choice the target committee identified at its first meeting was hardly big enough to confine the potential damage, it was the best the enemy had left to offer. Hiroshima is the largest untouched target not on the 21st Bomber Command priority list. Consideration should be given to this city. Tokyo, the committee notes continue, is a possibility, but it is now practically all bombed and burned out, and is practically rubble, with only the palace grounds left standing. Consideration is only possible here. The target committee did not yet fully understand the level of authority it commanded. With a few words to Groves, it could exempt a Japanese city from Curtis LeMay's relentless firebombing, preserving it through the spring mornings of cherry blossoms and summer nights of wild monsoons for a more historic fate. The committee thought it took second priority behind LeMay rather than first priority ahead, and in emphasizing these mistaken priorities, the colonel who reviewed the 20th Air Force's bombing directive for the committee revealed what the United States' policy in Japan, in all its deadly ambiguity, had become. It should be remembered that in our selection of any target, the 20th Air Force is operating primarily to laying waste all the main Japanese cities, and that they do not propose to save some important primary target for us if it interferes with the operation of the war from their point of view. Their existing procedure has been to bomb the hell out of Tokyo, bomb the aircraft, manufacturing and assembly plants, engine plants, and in general, paralyze the aircraft industry so as to eliminate opposition to the 20th Air Force operations. The 20th Air Force is systematically bombing out the following cities with the prime purpose in mind of not leaving one stone lying on another: Tokyo, Yokohama, Nagoya, Osaka, Kyoto, Kobe, Yawata, and Nagasaki. If the Japanese were prepared to eat stones, the Americans were prepared to supply them. The colonel also advised that the 20th Air Force planned to increase its delivery of conventional bombs steadily until it was dropping 100,000 tons a month by the end of 1945. The group decided to study 17 targets, including Tokyo Bay, Yokohama, Nagoya, Osaka, Kobe, Hiroshima, Kokura, Fukuoka, Nagasaki, and Sasebo. Targets already destroyed would be culled from the list. The weather people would review weather reports. Penny would consider the size of the bomb burst, the amount of damage expected, and the ultimate distance at which people would be killed. Von Neumann would be responsible for computations. Adjourning its initial meeting, the target committee planned to meet again in mid-May in Robert Oppenheimer's office at Los Alamos. A third level of discourse on the uses of the bomb revealed itself as Henry Stimson assembled a committee that Bush and Conant had proposed to him, and he had proposed in turn to the president. On May 1st, the day German radio announced the suicide of Adolf Hitler in the ruins of Berlin, George L. Harrison, a special Stimson consultant and the president of the New York Life Insurance Company, prepared for the Secretary of War an entirely civilian committee roster consisting of Stimson as chairman, Bush, Conant, MIT President Carl Compton, Assistant Secretary of State William L. Clayton, Undersecretary of the Navy Ralph A. Bard, and a special representative of the President, whom the President might choose. Stimson modified the list to include Harrison as his alternate and carried it to Truman for approval on May 2nd. Truman agreed, and Stimson apparently assumed his interest in the project. But the President significantly did not even bother to name his own man to the list. Stimson wrote in his diary that night, "The President accepted the present members of the committee and said that they would be sufficient even without a personal representative of himself. I said I should prefer to have such a representative and suggested that he should be a man, A, with whom the President had close personal relations, and B, who was able to keep his mouth shut." Truman had not yet announced his intention to appoint Burns Secretary of State because the holdover secretary, Edward R. Stettinius, Jr., was heading the United States delegation to the United Nations in San Francisco, and the President did not want to undercut his authority there. But word of the forthcoming appointment had diffused through Washington. Acting on it, Harrison suggested that Stimson propose Burns. On May 3rd, Stimson did. And late in the day, the President called me up himself and said that he had heard of my suggestion and it was fine. He had already called up Burns down in South Carolina, and Burns had accepted. Bundy and Harrison, Stimson told his diary, were tickled to death. They thought their committee had acquired a second powerful sponsor. In fact, they had just welcomed a cowbird into their nest. Stimson sent out invitations the next day. He proposed calling his new group the Interim Committee to avoid appearing to usurp congressional prerogatives. "When secrecy is no longer required," he explained to the prospective members, "Congress might wish to appoint a permanent post-war commission." He set the first informal meeting of the Interim Committee for May 9th. The membership would assemble in the wake of momentous change. The war in Europe had finally ground to an end. Supreme Allied Commander Dwight D. Eisenhower celebrated the victory on national radio the evening of Tuesday, May 8th, 1945, VE Day. "I have the rare privilege of speaking for a victorious army of almost 5 million fighting men. They, and the women who have so ably assisted them, constitute the Allied expeditionary force that has liberated Western Europe. They have destroyed or captured enemy armies totaling more than their own strength, and swept triumphantly forward over the hundreds of miles separating Cherbourg from Lübeck, Leipzig, and Munich. These startling successes have not been brought without sorrow and suffering. In this theater alone, 80,000 Americans and comparable numbers among their allies have had their lives cut short that the rest of us might live in the sunlight of freedom. But, at last, this part of the job is done. No more will there flow from this theater to the United States those doleful lists of death and loss that have brought so much sorrow to American homes. The sounds of battle have faded from the European scene." Eisenhower had watched Colonel General Alfred Jodl sign the act of military surrender in a schoolroom in Reims, the temporary war room of the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force, in the early morning hours of May 7th. Eisenhower's aides had attempted then to draft a suitably eloquent message to the combined chiefs reporting the official surrender. "I tried one myself," Eisenhower's chief of staff, Walter Bedell Smith, remembers, "and, like all my associates, groped for resounding phrases as fitting accolades to the Great Crusade and indicative of our dedication to the great task just accomplished." The Supreme Commander listened quietly for a time, thanked everyone for trying, and dictated his own unadorned report. "The mission of this Allied force was fulfilled at 0241 local time, May 7th, 1945. Better to be brief, better than resounding phrases. 20 million Soviet soldiers and civilians died of privation or in battle in the Second World War. 8 million British and Europeans died or were killed, and another 5 million Germans. The Nazis murdered 6 million Jews in ghettos and concentration camps. man-made death had ended 39 million human lives prematurely. For the second time in half a century, Europe had become a charnel house. There remained the brutal conflict Japan had begun in the Pacific and refused, despite her increasing destruction, to end by unconditional surrender. Officially, Burns was retired to South Carolina. In fact, he was visiting Washington surreptitiously, absorbing detailed evening briefings by State Department division chiefs at his apartment at the Shoreham Hotel. On the afternoon of VE Day, he spent 2 hours closeted alone with Stimson. Then Harrison, Bundy, and Groves joined them. "We all discussed the function of the proposed interim committee," Stimson records. "During the meeting, it became very evident what a tremendous help Burns would be as a member of the committee." The next morning, the interim committee met for the first time in Stimson's office. The gathering was preliminary to fill in Burns, States Clayton, and the Navy's Bard on the basic facts. But Stimson made a point of introducing the former assistant president as Truman's personal representative. The membership was thus put on notice that Burns enjoyed special status and that his words carried extra weight. The committee recognized that the scientists working on the atomic bomb might have useful advice to offer and created a scientific panel adjunct. Bush and Conant put their heads together and recommended Arthur Compton, Ernest Lawrence, Robert Oppenheimer, and Enrico Fermi for appointment. Between the first and second meetings of the interim committee, its doppelganger, the target committee, met again for 2 days, May 10th and 11th, at Los Alamos. Added to the full committee as advisors were Oppenheimer, Parsons, Tolman, and Norman Ramsey, and for part of the deliberations, Hans Bethe and Robert Brody. Oppenheimer took control by devising and presenting a thorough agenda. A. Height of detonation. B. Report on weather and operations. C. Gadget jettisoning and landing. D. Status of targets. E. Psychological factors in target selection. F. Use against military objectives. G. Radiological effects. H. Coordinated air operations. I. Rehearsals. J. Operating requirements for safety of airplanes. K. Coordination with 21st Bomber Command Program. Detonation height determined how large an area would be damaged by blast and depended crucially on yield. A bomb detonated too high would expend its energy blasting thin air. A bomb detonated too low would expend its energy excavating a crater. It was better to be low than high, the committee minutes explain. The bomb can be detonated as much as 40% below the optimum, with a reduction of 24% in area of damage, whereas a detonation only 14% above the optimum will cause the same loss in area. The discussion demonstrates how uncertain Los Alamos still was of bomb yield. Bethe estimated a yield range for Little Boy of 5,000 to 15,000 tons TNT equivalent. Fat Man, the implosion bomb, was anybody's guess. 700, 2,000, 5,000 tons? With the present information, the fuse would be set at 2,000 tons equivalent, but fusing for the other values should be available at the time of final delivery. Trinity data will be used for this gadget. The scientists reported, and the committee agreed, that in an emergency, a B-29 in good condition could return to base with a bomb. It should make a normal landing with the greatest possible care. The chances of a crash initiating a high-order, that is, nuclear explosion, are sufficiently small as to be a justifiable risk. Fat Man could even survive jettisoning into shallow water. Little Boy was less forgiving. Since the gun bomb contained more than two critical masses of U-235, seawater leaking into its casing could moderate stray neutrons sufficiently to initiate a destructive slow neutron chain reaction. The alternative, jettisoning Little Boy onto land, might loose the U-235 bullet down the barrel into the target core and set off a nuclear explosion. For temperamental Little Boy, the minutes note, unluckily for the air crew, the best emergency procedure that has so far been proposed is the removal of the gunpowder from the gun and the execution of a crash landing. Target selection had advanced. The committee had refined its qualifications to three. important targets in large urban area of more than 3 miles diameter that were capable of being damaged effectively by blast and were likely to be unattacked by next August. The Air Force had agreed to reserve 5 such targets for atomic bombing. These included 1. Kyoto. This target is an urban industrial area with a population of 1 million. It is the former capital of Japan, and many people and industries are now being moved there as other areas are being destroyed. From the psychological point of view, there is the advantage that Kyoto is an intellectual center for Japan, and the people there are more apt to appreciate the significance of such a weapon as the gadget. 2. Hiroshima. This is an important army depot and port of embarkation in the middle of an urban industrial area. It is a good radar target, and it is such a size that a large part of the city could be extensively damaged. There are adjacent hills, which are likely to produce a focusing effect, which would considerably increase the blast damage. Due to rivers, it is not a good incendiary target. The other 3 targets proposed were Yokohama, Kokura Arsenal, and the Niigata. An unsung enthusiast on the committee suggested a spectacular 6th target for consideration, but wiser heads prevailed. The possibility of bombing the Emperor's palace was discussed. It was agreed that we should not recommend it, but that any action for this bombing should come from authorities on military policy. So the target committee, sitting in Oppenheimer's office at Los Alamos under the modified Lincoln quotation that Oppenheimer had posted on the wall, "This world cannot endure half slave and half free," remanded 4 targets to further study: Kyoto, Hiroshima, Yokohama, and Kokura Arsenal. The committee and its Los Alamos consultants were not unmindful of the radiation effects of the atomic bomb, its most significant difference in effect from conventional high explosives, but worried more about radiation danger to American air crews than to the Japanese. Dr. Oppenheimer presented a memo he had prepared on the radiological effect of the gadget. The basic recommendations of this memo are: 1. For radiological reasons, no aircraft should be closer than 2.5 miles to the point of detonation. For blast reasons, the distance should be greater. And 2. Aircraft must avoid the cloud of radioactive materials. Since the expected yields of the bombs under discussion made them something less than city busters, the target committee considered following Little Boy and Fat Man with conventional incendiary raids. Radioactive clouds that might endanger LeMay's follow-up crews worried the targeters, though they thought an incendiary raid delayed 1 day after an atomic bombing might be safe and quite effective. With a better sense for having visited Los Alamos of the weapons it was targeting, the target committee scheduled its next meeting for May 28th at the Pentagon. Vannevar Bush thought the second interim committee meeting on May 14th produced very frank discussions. The group, he decided, was an excellent one. These judgments he passed along to Conant, who had been unable to attend. Stimson won approval of the scientific panel as constituted and discussed the possibility of assembling a similar group of industrialists. As his agenda noted, such a group would advise of the likelihood of other nations repeating what our industry has done. That is, whether other nations could build the vast, innovative industrial plant necessary to produce atomic bombs. That May Monday morning, the committee received copies of Bush's and Conant's September 30, 1944 memorandum to Stimson. The discussion, framed on Bohr's ideas of the free exchange of scientific information and inspection, not only of laboratories throughout the world, but also of military installations. Bush promptly hedged his commitment to so open a world. "I said that while we made the memorandum very explicit, that it certainly did not indicate that we were irrevocably committed to any definite line of action, but rather felt that we ought to express our ideas early in order that there might be discussion as a result of which we might indeed change our thoughts as we studied into the subject further. And I said also that we would undoubtedly write the memorandum a little differently today due to the lapse of time since last September." At the end of the meeting, Burns took his copy along and studied it with interest. The Secretary of State designate was learning fast. When the interim committee met again on Friday, May 18th, with Groves sitting in, Burns brought up the Bush-Conant memorandum as soon as draft press releases announcing the dropping of the first atomic bomb on Japan had been reviewed. It was Bush's turn to be absent. Conant passed along the news. Mr. Burns spent considerable time discussing our memorandum of last fall, which he had read carefully and with which he was much impressed. It apparently stimulated his thinking, which was all that we had originally desired, I imagine. He was particularly impressed with our statement that the Russians might catch up in 3 to 4 years. This premise was violently opposed by the general, that is, Groves, who felt that 20 years was a much better figure. The general is basing his long estimate on a very poor view of Russian ability, which I think is a highly unsafe assumption. There was some discussion about the implications of a time interval as short as 4 years, and various international problems were discussed, particularly the question of whether or not the president should tell the Russians of the existence of the weapon after the July test. Bohr's proposal to enlist the Soviet Union in discussions before the atomic bomb became a reality here slips to the question of whether or not to tell the Soviets the bare facts after the bomb had been tested, but before the second was dropped on Japan. Burns thought the answer to that question might depend on how quickly the USSR could duplicate the American accomplishment. The Interim Committee's recording secretary, Second Lieutenant R. Gordon Arneson, remembered after the war of this confrontation that Mr. Burns felt that this point was a very important one. The veteran of House and Senate cloakrooms was at least as concerned as Henry Stimson to extract a quid pro quo for any exchange of information, as Conant's next comment to Bush demonstrates. The question, that is, whether or not to tell the Russians about the atomic bomb before using it on Japan, led to the review of the Quebec Agreement, which was shown once more to Mr. Burns. He asked the general what we had got in exchange, and the general replied only the arrangements controlling the Belgian Congo. Mr. Burns made short work of this line of argument. The Quebec Agreement of 1943 renewed the partnership of the United States and Great Britain in the nuclear enterprise. Groves was justifying it as an exchange for British help in securing the Union Minière's agreement to sell the two nations all its uranium ore. The British-American relation was built on deeper foundations than that, and Conant moved quickly to limit the damage of Groves's blunder. Some of us then pointed out the historic background and that our connection with England flowed from the original agreement as to the complete exchange of scientific information. I can foresee a great deal of trouble on this front. It was interesting that Mr. Burns felt that Congress would be most curious about this phase of the matter. If Burns had begun his service on the interim committee respecting the men who had carried the Manhattan Project forward, he must have conceived less respect for them now. Both Stimson and Bush, Conant told Burns, had talked to Churchill in Quebec. If, as it seemed, they could be conned by the British into giving away the secrets of the bomb, whatever Burns imagined those might be, for the price of a few tons of uranium ore, how much was their judgment worth? Why give away something so stupendous as the bomb, unless you got something equally stupendous in return? Burns believed international relations worked like domestic politics. The bomb was power, newly minted, and power was to politics as money was to banking, a medium of enriching exchange. Only naifs and fools gave it away. Enter Leo Szilard. As the man who had thought longer and harder than anyone else about the consequences of the chain reaction, Szilard had chafed at his continuing exile from the high councils of government. Another politically active MetLab scientist, Eugene Rabinowitch, a younger man, confirms the feeling, which was certainly shared by others, that we were surrounded by a kind of soundproof wall, so that you could write to Washington or go to Washington and talk to somebody, but you never got any reaction back. With the successful operation of the production reactors and separation plants at Hanford, the work of the Met Lab had slowed. Compton's people, Szilard particularly, found time to think about the future. Szilard says he began to examine the wisdom of testing bombs and using bombs. Rabinowitz remembers many hours spent walking up and down the Midway, the wide World's Fair sward south of the University of Chicago main campus, with Leo Szilard, and arguing about these questions and about what can be done. I remember sleepless nights. There was no point in talking to Groves, Szilard reasoned in March 1945, nor to Bush or Conant for that matter. Secrecy barred discussion with middle-level authorities. The only man with whom we were sure we would be entitled to communicate, Szilard recalls, was the president. He prepared a memorandum for Franklin Roosevelt and traveled to Princeton to enlist once again the durable services of Albert Einstein. Except for some minor theoretical calculations for the Navy, Einstein had been excluded from wartime nuclear development. Bush explained why to the director of the Institute for Advanced Study early in the war. I am not at all sure that if I place Einstein in entire contact with his subject, he would not discuss it in a way that it should not be discussed. I wish very much that I could place the whole thing before him, but this is utterly impossible in view of the attitude of people here in Washington who have studied into his whole history. The great theoretician, whose letter to Roosevelt helped alert the United States government to the possibility of an atomic bomb, was thus spared by concern for security and by hostility to his earlier outspoken politics, his pacifism, and probably also his Zionism, from contributing to that weapon's development. Szilard could not show Einstein his memorandum. He told his old friend simply that there was trouble ahead and asked for a letter of introduction to the president. Einstein complied. From Chicago, Szilard approached Roosevelt through his wife. Eleanor Roosevelt agreed to see him on May 8th to pursue the matter. Thus fortified, he wandered to Arthur Compton's office to confess his out-of-channel sins. Compton surprised him by cheering him on. Elated by finding no resistance where I expected resistance, Szilard reports, I went back to my office. I had been in my office for 5 minutes when there was a knock on the door and Compton's assistant came in, telling me he had just heard over the radio that President Roosevelt had died. So for a number of days, I was at a complete loss for what to do. Szilard goes on. He needed a new avenue of approach. Eventually, it occurred to him that a project as large as the Met Lab probably employed someone from Kansas City, Missouri, Harry Truman's original political base. He found a young mathematician named Albert Kahn, who had worked for Kansas City boss Tom Pendergast's political machine to earn money for graduate school. Kahn and Szilard traveled to Kansas City later that month, dazzled Pendergast's hoodlum elite with who knows what Szilardian tale, and 3 days later we had an appointment at the White House. Truman's appointment secretary, Matthew Connolly, barred the door. After he read the Einstein letter and the memorandum, he relaxed. I see now, Szilard remembers him saying. This is a serious matter. At first I was a little suspicious because the appointment came through Kansas City. Truman had guessed the subject of Szilard's concern. At the president's direction, Connolly sent the wandering Hungarian to Spartanburg, South Carolina, to talk to a private citizen named Jimmy Burns. A University of Chicago dean, a scientist named Walter Bartke, had accompanied Szilard to Washington. For added authority, Szilard enlisted Nobel laureate Harold Urey, and the three men boarded the overnight train south. Compartmentalization was working. We did not quite understand why we were sent by the president to see James Burns. Was he to be the man in charge of the uranium work after the war, or what? We did not know. Truman had alerted Burns that the delegation was on its way. The South Carolinian received it warily at his home. He read the letter from Einstein first. I have much confidence in Szilard's judgment, the theoretician of relativity testified, then turned to the memorandum. It was a prescient document. It argued that, in preparing to test and then use atomic bombs, the United States was moving along a road leading to the destruction of the strong position the nation hitherto occupied in the world. Szilard was referring not to a moral advantage, but to an industrial. As he wrote elsewhere that spring, U.S. military strength was essentially due to the fact that the United States could outproduce every other country in heavy armaments. When other countries acquired nuclear weapons, as they would in just a few years, that advantage would be lost. Perhaps the greatest immediate danger which faces us is the probability that our demonstration of atomic bombs will precipitate a race in the production of these devices between the United States and Russia. Much of the rest of the memorandum asked the sort of questions the interim committee was also asking about international controls versus attempting to maintain an American monopoly. But Szilard echoed Bohr in pleading for what no one among the national leaders concerned with the problem seemed able to grasp, that these decisions ought to be based not on the present evidence relating to atomic bombs, but rather on the situation which can be expected to confront us in this respect a few years from now. By present evidence, the bombs were modest, and the United States held them in monopoly. The difficulty was deciding what the future would bring. Szilard first offended Burns in his memorandum by concluding that this situation can be evaluated only by men who have first-hand knowledge of the facts involved, that is, by the small group of scientists who are actively engaged in this work. Having thus informed Burns that he thought him unqualified, Szilard then proceeded to tell him how his inadequacies might be corrected. If there were in existence a small subcommittee of the cabinet, having as its members the Secretary of War, either the Secretary of Commerce or the Secretary of the Interior, a representative of the State Department, and a representative of the President, acting as the Secretary of the Committee, the scientists could then submit to such a committee their recommendations. It was H.G. Wells's open conspiracy emerging again into the light. It amused Burns, a man who had climbed to the top across 45 years of hard political service. Not at all. Szilard complained that he and some of his associates did not know enough about the policy of the government with regard to the use of the bomb. He felt that scientists, including himself, should discuss the matter with the cabinet, which I did not feel desirable. His general demeanor and his desire to participate in policy making made an unfavorable impression on me. Burns proceeded to demonstrate the dangers of a lack of first-hand knowledge, Szilard remembers. When I spoke of my concern that Russia might become an atomic power, and might become an atomic power soon, if we demonstrated the power of the bomb and if we used it against Japan, his reply was, "General Groves tells me there is no uranium in Russia." So Szilard explained to Burns what Groves, busy buying up the world supply of high-grade ore, apparently did not understand that high-grade deposits are necessary for the extraction of so rare an element as radium, but the low-grade ores, which undoubtedly existed in the Soviet Union, were entirely satisfactory where so abundant an element as uranium was concerned. To Szilard's argument that using the atomic bomb, even testing the atomic bomb, would be unwise because it would disclose that the weapon existed, Burns took a turn at teaching the physicist a lesson in domestic politics. He said, "We had spent $2 billion on developing the bomb, and Congress would want to know what we had got for the money spent." He said, "How do you get Congress to appropriate money for atomic research if you do not show results for the money which has been spent already?" But Burns's most dangerous misunderstanding from Szilard's point of view was his reading of the Soviet Union. Burns thought that the war would be over in about 6 months. He was concerned about Russia's post-war behavior. Russian troops had moved into Hungary and Romania. and Burns thought it would be very difficult to persuade Russia to withdraw her troops from these countries, that Russia might be more manageable if impressed by American military might, and that a demonstration of the bomb might impress Russia. I shared Burns' concern about Russia's throwing around her weight in the post-war period, but I was completely flabbergasted by the assumption that rattling the bomb might make Russia more manageable. Shadowed by one of Groves' ubiquitous security agents, the three discouraged men caught the next train back to Washington. There, on the same day, the Target Committee was meeting, this time with Paul Tibbetts, as well as Tolman and Parsons on hand. Much of the discussion concerned Tibbetts' training program for the 509th Composite Group. He had sent his best crews to Cuba for 6 weeks to give them radar experience and flying time over water. On load and distance tests, the committee minutes report, Colonel Tibbetts stated crews had taken off at 135,000 pounds gross load, flown 4,300 miles with 10,000 pound bomb load, bombed from 32,000 feet, and returned to base with 900 gallons of fuel. This is in excess of the expected target run, and further tests will reduce the loading to reach the SOP, standard operating procedure, of 500 gallons of fuel on return. The 509th was in the process of staging out to Tinian. Pumpkin production was increasing. 19 had been shipped to Wendover, and some of them dropped. LeMay was also keeping busy. The three reserved targets for the first unit of this project were announced, with current and prospective rate of 20th Air Force HE bombing. It is expected to complete strategic bombing of Japan by 1 January 46, so availability of future targets will be a problem. If the Manhattan Project did not hurry, that is, there would be no cities left in Japan to bomb. Kyoto, Hiroshima, and Niigata were the three targets reserved. The committee completed its review by abandoning any pretension that its objectives there were military. The following conclusions were reached. 1. Not to specify aiming points, this is to be left to later determination at base when weather conditions are known. 2. To neglect location of industrial areas as pinpoint target, since on these three targets such areas are small, spread on fringes of cities, and quite dispersed. 3. To endeavor to place first gadget in center of selected city, that is, not to allow for later one or two gadgets for complete destruction. And that was that. The target committee would schedule no more meetings, but would remain on call. Stimson abhorred bombing cities. As he wrote in his third-person memoir after the war, for 30 years, Stimson had been a champion of international law and morality. As soldier and cabinet officer, he had repeatedly argued that war itself must be restrained within the bounds of humanity. Perhaps, as he later said, he was misled by the constant talk of precision bombing. But he had believed that even air power could be limited in its use by the old concept of legitimate military targets. Firebombing was a kind of total war he had always hated. He seems to have conceived the idea that even the atomic bomb could be somehow humanely applied, as he discussed with Truman on May 16th. I am anxious to hold our Air Force, so far as possible, to the precision bombing which it has done so well in Europe. I am told that it is possible and adequate. The reputation of the United States for fair play and humanitarianism is the world's biggest asset for peace in the coming decades. I believe the same rule of sparing the civilian population should be applied, as far as possible, to the use of any new weapons. But the Secretary of War had less control over the military forces he was delegated to administer than he would have liked. And 9 days later, on May 25th, 464 of LeMay's B-29s, nearly twice as many as flew the first low-level March 9th incendiary raid, once again successfully burned out nearly 16 square miles of Tokyo. although the Strategic Bombing Survey asserts that only a few thousand Japanese were killed compared to the 86,000 it totals for the earlier conflagration. The newspapers made much of the late May fire raid. Stimson was appalled. On May 30th, Groves crossed the river from his Virginia Avenue offices and hove into view. Stimson's frustration at the bombing of Japanese cities ignited a fateful exchange, as the general later told an interviewer. "I was over in Mr. Stimson's office talking to him about some matter in connection with the bomb, when he asked me if I had selected the targets yet. I replied that I had that report already, and I expected to take it over to General Marshall the following morning for his approval. Mr. Stimson then said, 'Well, your report is all finished, isn't it?' I said, 'I haven't gone over it yet, Mr. Stimson. I want to be sure that I've got it just right.' He said, 'Well, I would like to see it.' And I said, 'Well, it's across the river, and it would take a long time to get it.' He said, 'I have all day, and I know how fast your office operates. Here's a phone on this desk. You pick it up and you call your office and have them bring that report over.' Well, it took about 15 or 20 minutes to get that report there, and all the time I was stewing and fretting internally over the fact that I was shortcutting General Marshall. But there was nothing I could do, and when I protested slightly that I thought it was something that General Marshall should pass on first, Mr. Stimson said, 'This is one time I'm going to be the final deciding authority. Nobody's going to tell me what to do on this. On this matter, I am the kingpin, and you might just as well get that report over here.' Well, in the meantime, he asked me what cities I was planning to bomb, or what targets. I informed him and told him that Kyoto was the preferred target. It was the first one, because it was of such size that we would have no question about the effects of the bomb. He immediately said, 'I don't want Kyoto bombed.' And he went on to tell me about its long history as a cultural center of Japan, the former ancient capital, and a great many reasons why he did not want to see it bombed. When the report came over, and I handed it to him, his mind was made up. There's no question about that. He read it over, and he walked to the door separating his office from General Marshall's, opened it, and said, 'General Marshall, if you're not busy, I wish you'd come in.' And then the secretary really double-crossed me, because without any explanation, he said to General Marshall, 'Marshall, Groves has just brought me his report on the proposed targets. He said, I don't like it. I don't like the use of Kyoto.' So Kyoto, at least, the Rome of Japan, founded in 793, famous for silk and cloisonné, a center of the Buddhist and Shinto religions with hundreds of historic temples and shrines, would be spared, though Groves would continue to test his superior's resolve in the weeks to come. The Imperial Palace in Tokyo had been similarly spared, even as Tokyo was laid waste around it. There were still limits to the destructiveness of war. The weapons were still modest enough to allow such fine discriminations. The interim committee was to meet in full dress with its scientific panel on Thursday, May 31st, and on Friday, June 1st, with its industrial advisors. The Joint Chiefs of Staff prepared the ground for those meetings on May 25th when they issued a formal directive to the Pacific commanders and to Hap Arnold, defining U.S. military policy toward Japan in the months to come. The Joint Chiefs of Staff direct the invasion of Kyushu, Operation Olympic, target date 1 November 1945, in order to 1. Intensify the blockade and aerial bombardment of Japan. 2. Contain and destroy major enemy forces. 3.